Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
At this point, let's move fully into role model, setting up standards that are, that become unrealistic, and yet we don't realize that we're interacting with caricatures or ideal types or archetypes rather than real human beings. And so we kind of got into that a little bit beforehand, but let's move more fully into that and the different ways that, again, we'll go with Islander pressures and expectations. And like you said, Anapesi, maybe on two hands you can count the positive role models that are out there, and I'm guessing quite a few of them are athletes, Troy Polamalu, and all those kinds of things. And so Teo was part of that. So let's kind of talk about that, both with Islander and Mormon stuff. But I'm going to go ahead and say at this point, Teo he's still managed to be quite a compelling figure for me. I've read this transcript. It was 32 pages when I printed it out, and everything I've seen about him, I can just relate to him as an individual. I can see, just saying one little thing and not correcting it, and thinking of others rather than myself, in terms of, coming 100% clean because I know I'm providing inspiration or whatnot. So he's still working for me. I have my filters kind of down, so it'll be up to you guys to help me face my own idealization of him at this point. So I just want to say that off the beginning. Let's go ahead and jump within that. And Stephen, I don't know, you began a line of inquiry that I'd been thinking of as a big piece of this too, and that is, we know these stories, we know these frameworks, we kind of know, what pushes buttons, what raises spirits and things like that. And so we do structure our narratives and our own lives, and we sort of frame them within that. And so your fellow who felt the pressure to be inspirational and came up with an odd way of doing it in priesthood meeting is just something. How do you see that playing into the Teo story of this this guy who recognizes he's a very public figure and he wants to deliver the goods? It's a very sincere thing of his, and we're not saying that he's self-deluded into thinking he's a better guy than he is, or anything like that. But I'm just saying, talk about that idea of being an icon, or at least representing an ideal.
Well, when I was doing my dissertation, two of the scholars who affected me a lot are Clandon and Connolly, and they also studied the stories that teachers tell. And they came up with this really interesting structure to describe what it was that they were seeing when teachers would tell them stories about, their time teaching. They saw that these teachers told different stories depending on who their audience was. So if they were talking amongst teachers, they would tell a story one way. If they were talking with parents or with someone outside of the teaching community, they would tell it another way. And if they were speaking very publicly, they would tell the story in another way. So they found these sort of three types of stories, and they called it the sacred story, the cover story, and the private story. Mm. And so basically what they saw was that when they were talking with people with whom they had a lot of, I guess, affinity, where you could kind of be more vulnerable because everybody sort of shared the same experience, they all knew where you were coming from, you could tell the private story. And you could say, my gosh, this kid drives me up the wall. I would strangle him if given the chance. Whereas if they were talking with their parents or with somebody in the town or in the village, they would say, "Oh, yeah, he's quite a handful, but boy, do I love the kid. You know, he's going to grow up to be something great someday." And then, of course, the sacred story was the great big overarching narrative that we have about how wonderful teaching is, and the beauty of education, and the self-sacrificing teachers, and how much joy they get from watching their students grow up.
And all of these are authentic stories, right? They're not deliberately dissembling here, right?
Well, it depends on how you define dissembling, because if you want to talk about, you know, the deep raw feelings of the teacher, then yeah, it is dissembling. But you realize that when you're talking with other people, you're entering a larger discourse, and people don't go, okay, so when you're talking with someone at a party and they just start giving out too much information, and they're just letting you way too deep into their psyche, into their perverse, perverse ideas.
Been
you
there.
Say, "Please stop, please," because they're sort of derailing the larger discourse that we're all comfortable in, that allows all of us to sort of work together, right? And so that's why you instinctively know that you don't let your strangulation fantasies out. Of the student, anyway. and so you realize that your deepest feelings need to come into conversation somehow with the rest of the world. And so Teo is very much in that sort of position, because not only is he sort of an inspiring figure for becoming such a great athlete, but he also has, as we've been talking about, the honor of his community to uphold, the honor of his family. And so the sacred story has a huge impact on anything that he's going to say. And it's hard to know how much of his deep private thoughts really should be counted as, I suppose, truth. I don't know. Where is truth located within those three stories?
I would look at him as, when I see the situational thing that you're kind of playing up here, still, I would believe that the teacher who wants to strangle the rambunctious child also still believes the other two.
Well, yeah.
You know, so it's not false, it's just not whole.
Right. Mm-hmm. And those were the things that I was also seeing when I was doing my own research. I would be in the villages. I would go to visit teachers in Alaska Native villages, and I would listen to their stories as they were in the thick of things. I chose first year teachers who'd come from the lower 48 because they had no experience whatsoever in Alaska Native villages or with the culture. And so they were in the middle of this raw experience, and they'd be telling me these things just sort of in stream of consciousness, and it was all raw and usually politically incorrect. And then a few months later, I would come back and they'd start telling, and I'd start drawing these stories out of them again, and they tell them completely differently. They would always sort of make them revolve around sort of a moral or an idea. They would say, "Boy, when I first came here, I had no idea how to interact with them. But then I started to discover, you know, this principle. And I discovered it when I was in this situation." And they would tell me a situation very much like what they told me earlier, but very much different. And I would bet you money they would be totally surprised if I had like had a tape recorder in my pocket and I let them listen to the way that they had been telling their story to begin with. They would say, "Oh man, that's not me." Mm-hmm. And so when we start telling these stories, we in fact sort of mold our brains differently. We mold the stories around principles instead of around the story itself.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're such meaning-making creatures that we do this so intuitively. And I mean, I don't know what you have to say about this, Stephen, but I guess my thought about that is that part of my critique of our culture sometimes is that we put so much pressure around particular kind of stories that at least in my language, what I would consider more authentic accountings of our experience get suppressed or pushed away. So that, like in the example you're giving, in some ways I can kind of see the legitimacy of all three accounts. I can see how all of them are a part of the truth. But in certain groups, it feels like, you know, certain stories aren't allowed to be told. And I think, you know, sometimes I wonder if we do a disservice to ourselves. I sometimes feel like, you know, women often don't feel very comfortable in Relief Society. And I sometimes think that's because the stories that are permitted, at least perceived to be permitted, are stories that can make some people feel estranged or like their experience is too far outside of what is acceptable. And it's too inauthentic. So I don't know if you have thoughts about that and how it relates to our Mormon culture.
Well, certainly that's the reason why, you know, like the feminist Mormon housewives and stuff are such popular areas,
right?
Is because those are constructed in such a way that you can put out these raw stories that don't fit well into, you're right, sort of the larger tide. I like to say that Mormons are in the middle of recycling a 4-year cyclical poem in church. And every time we come around to the principle that we were on four years ago, we take turns saying the same things that we said last time. We just sort of mm-hmm. go around and around and around. And if you try to introduce something new in there, it's going to kind of jar things. Mm-hmm. And people don't like being jarred. I mean,
mm-hmm. right. Yeah,
you know what you said, Jennifer, about those you know, it's perceived that the more complex and the raw earth stories aren't welcome, but yet when you do offer them, the whole room lights up, the discussion mm-hmm. becomes the best ever. So again, a piece mm-hmm. of this podcast is always saying, feel free to be authentic. Stephen, you gave me language, back before you became the editor, when we were just friends and I was actually kind of whining and dining you to be my successor there at Sunstone. And I've used it often on this podcast, but it's just a good reminder that Mormons, you kind of talked about the structure of plays and often having three acts. You know, uh-huh. there's the preamble and all that stuff, and then Act 2 is where all the action is, and Act 3 is where the resolution comes. And you've mentioned how Mormons, and I think this is just human nature, and this is why a whole lot of people don't like independent films, because they often, you know, don't resolve things. And so Mormons are very comfortable with the person being a wayward person and having a complex view, but they don't want to hear about it in the middle of that. They want to hear it as the person came to resolve it in a familiar and a, you know, in a tried and true way. And so I appreciate that language that you'd give me, Stephen, of the three acts and how we love those act threes. And so we present act threes.
It's mm-hmm. true. And one thing F. Scott Fitzgerald once said, you know, American lives don't have second acts. And so that might be part of our problem if we're both American and Mormon.
Anna Pessy, throw some Islander things onto this, or let's all of us, we've kind of talked universal humanness here with hardly any Mormon layers. So anything that you want to throw on there to keep this going as far as the pressure for him as a role model or just this need as Mormons to be inspirational?
I think another part of that is that we have these stories that we tell, but then there's also another kind of story that is shaped and perpetuated by the media. And I think that's something that is pretty clear in this case where he, of course, you know, this is his experience and it's, you know, the things that he's decided to share publicly. But the media has also shaped the story in a certain way. And there are certain stories that the media will privilege over others. And that story is usually what sticks because that's what is given to the masses. And I see that with his, you know, with Manti's situation where if he was to offer a different story, which we do see coming out now, it's still being filtered in the way the media sees it fit for that story to come out. And I think that's where social media has become so popular, because the stories that are coming from social media is sort of informing the larger narrative that is being perpetuated by the mainstream media. And so I think that that's another you know, another piece of it as we're thinking about the ways in which we share these stories and how we share them, and the need to be inspirational wanting to be inspirational. At the same time, there it doesn't ever come out unfiltered. You know, it's filtered in a certain way when it comes out to the masses.
That is so great to always remember that we are being manipulated, not necessarily in a Machiavelli, you know, a terrible way, but just for things are always presented to us, and they're mm-hmm. never, and yeah, they're always shaped. Awesome. There's that whole other, again, I think it's in this act failure to share act two and things like that, is there's that whole sense of we don't like to be uncomfortable ourselves as human beings, mm-hmm. and Mormons don't like to, because we like to have the answers. You know, we have the golden questions, but really we have the golden answers to the why, mm-hmm. where, you know, all those kinds of things. And so there's that idea of I don't want to make other people uncomfortable. I just released a podcast, you know, with children who, you know, parents telling the story of, you know, their faith transitioning or becoming more complicated. And as the parents tell, these kids were all hesitant to share with them. And sometimes there's good reasons for that and stuff like that. We're always hesitant to tell somebody that I'm not, you know, who you think I am exactly, and to be authentic. And that's a very difficult thing to do. What else in, let's talk about Paul Dunn for a second, guys. Mm-hmm. and again, Anapesi, you kind of talked about Manti, you know, he gets that crazy call on December 6th where I'm not dead after all, and you know, and yet he continues on through, you know, it's after the bowl game, and so there's, you know, there's a whole month there of confusion and whatnot for him, but he didn't want to complicate anybody else's life. He was still trying to figure it out himself. He knew that he was an inspirational thing, and so when the media just looking for the sound bites leading up to the game, and the media had loved this story. There's a great piece, if anybody hasn't read it, it's on a blog, and I know it's Malcolm Gladwell and somebody else. Have you guys read that? Where they're talking about back and forth the Teo story, and Malcolm Gladwell is busy. So this is the you know, he says I'm less interested in Manti Te'o in terms of what he, you know, how much he knew and when he knew it and all that stuff. He goes, why did we as Americans buy it? And he says, mm-hmm. because you have those great stories. Like, for instance, he used the movie Love Story, the beautiful girl who dies. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we love that one's bound to grab our hearts. And then he says, then there's that inspiration, win-win for the Gipper, you know, kind of thing. And so here he starts going into Notre Dame, Newt Rockne, and the inspirational speech where here Te'o is, you know, he's has that extra motivation because he's, you know, thinking of his girlfriend and his grandmother and does it. And then there's the he calls it the Icarus myth, the hero who flies too close to the sun. And this is Linne, you know, having the car accident and the tragic, you know, kind of thing. And so here's this wonderful story that we always want to root for. And, you know, when they do the Olympic profiles of the athletes, there's always some element of overcoming, you know, homelessness or single parentness, or, you know, thankful for the grandmother who in the midst of the projects of New York, you know, wouldn't let me step out of line, you know, kind of thing. And so we have all these wonderful stories there. So let's talk about Paul Dunn. I teased him a little bit. For those who are maybe younger, Paul Dunn was certainly, and I'm 53, and so right in my teenage years and young adulthood, he is the most popular general authority. He, you know, writes books that would sell like crazy at Deseret Book, and they're full of stories and inspirational things, and there were pieces of his own life that would weave their ways into these stories. And for instance, that he at one time was a minor league baseball player in the St. Louis Cardinals organization, and then there was experiences that he had in the war of, you know, a fellow soldier dying in his arms and offering, I can't remember exactly what his, you know, dying words, but they were very inspirational and heart-tugging, and audiences would, you know, walk away inspired by, you know, if this is what this guy would say is the most important thing at the end of his life, then that's something I need to build my life around. And so Paul Dunn was sort of this industry within Mormon general authorities of, you know, being the one who could reach and inspire the youth and young adults more than anybody else. And then it turned out that he had fabricated or amplified or shaped these stories perhaps for effect. And so I know that a lot of people are looking at Manti Te'o and they're saying, not only what I've just kind of was arguing about about Malcolm Gladwell, saying, why do we all believe it? But there's that element of maybe somebody, you know, recognizing, whether it's conscious or whatnot, what works and what doesn't work, what lights up people's eyes, what, you know, lifts their energy or whatever. And so Te'o as a fireside speaker or as a, you know, person speaking, you know, he would highlight certain pieces of it. So I don't know, any of you, is there anything about the Paul Dunn kind of episode that relates to Te'o in your mind, or at least what are some thoughts that come up?
I mean, I think that, you know, I remember listening to Paul Dunn recording some like tape cassettes as a little girl and as an adolescent, and I loved those stories. I mean, they were so inspiring and they were so moving, and, you know, I had so much admiration and respect for him as a person. And, you know, it was quite disillusioning to find out that these stories were fabricated, that they weren't, in fact, real experiences that he had. And I mean,
well, not everything that he said, obviously, but there were some clear ones
details
where
around these stories were forced, at least. And so, you know, I think that what someone like Paul Dunn and you know, Manti Te'o, I read that story differently than when I first saw it. When I first saw it, my first impression was, this is somebody who knows how to speak to the public and knows exactly what story they want to hear and knows how to basically exploit that. That's how I first read it. I see it differently now, kind of seeing more details and how he did truly get caught up in a hoax. But, you know, there is still this element of at least what the media was feeding on was the story that we all want to hear. And the reason why we were so, you know, unscrutinizingly willing to eat up Paul Dunn's stories is because it speaks to the pieces that we most want to believe, or the, I don't know, we love to be inspired. We love to be told that sacred story, so to speak. And, you know, I remember listening to This American Life several years ago, and there was a piece that was being done on compulsive liars. And one of the people being interviewed had shared a room at Harvard with a roommate who was a compulsive liar. And he talked about, you know, he was friends with the Kennedy family and that he was going down to, you know, to visit them on the weekends, and that he would buy into all of this. And the thing he said about himself was that I wanted so much to believe these stories that even as they started kind of coming apart, or there started to be evidence that was inconsistent with what he was saying, that it took him a long time to let himself see the truth of that this person was lying to him, because he wanted so much to believe he was roommates with this person who was connected with the Kennedys and had all these amazing experiences.
One fewer degree of separation for him from the Kennedys, yeah.
Exactly. So that's a link that I see between the two.
Interesting.
Well, I was just noticing, talking about the story that we want to hear so much, and it's true that there are elements to stories that we really want to hear. And the difficulty is that when stories encounter life, things inevitably get messy, and this sort of addiction to the story that we want to hear is, from what I've seen, one of the reasons why lifelong Orthodox Mormons become so destabilized when they start encountering details that hadn't been included in the story that they wanted to hear so much. Mm-hmm. And if we're constantly feeding ourselves on these stories that we know how it's going to go and we love it and it's true, well, I want to compare it to this. I was sitting in a classroom listening to some Alaska Native elders talk to their teenagers, and they were boring old guys, and they were cute as heck. And they were telling these stories. You know, I was out on the ice, and the ice broke beneath me, but I had my pole with me. And they were talking about, you know, how they didn't manage to fall through the ice by using this pole, and how they got home, and how they made themselves a snow cave, and things like that. And that's a really helpful thing to hear when you live in Alaska. In rural Alaska, because when you go out into the landscape, the landscape does particular things. And if the story you've been given connects well with that landscape and you actually interact constructively with that landscape and you live, then that's a good story. But when you have these stories that tell you what you want to hear, just because, you know, we've done the research and we know what people want to hear, then when people interact with the actual landscape of life and it sort of breaks apart that story that we loved so much, we find ourselves, you know, not knowing how to build a snow cave.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, absolutely.
That bugs me, but I also understand why people love those stories so much. It's just that they're going to get bitten.
Yeah.
Terrific.
I also see this as part of the larger American dream narrative, and that there that we're drawn to these types of stories of the person who was able to start from nothing and go to something wonderful and amazing. And I remember even in the work that I do with the social justice scholars up on campus at the University of Utah, one of the things that we've done we've gone into various media outlets here in Utah, and we've looked at representations or misrepresentations of people of color in the state of Utah, and have talked to them about adding in different stories that is more representative of the experiences of individuals here. And consistently, every single editor has asked us for this particular narrative, this pattern where individual came from nothing, somehow triumphed in something, you know, and that's what they want to hear. They don't want to hear any of the other stories of the challenges, of the struggles, you know, the things that are the reality of what's really happening in many of these communities. What they want to hear are these Manti Te'o stories prior to what's come out now, but really that story about how they've basically pulled themselves up by their bootstraps to be in this, you know, to be in this amazing space. And I think because that relates to the American dream, and it makes Americans feel better about who they are to see other people being able to do that. And it helps them to really see that it is possible to be whatever, this whole narrative of meritocracy, to be whatever you want to be, you know, if you work hard enough. And I saw that was Manti Te'o's story, aside from the spiritual aspect that was brought into it. They were looking at it as this young man, you know, who came from the islands, came to La'ie, and then somehow went from this little small, you know, city or village in Hawaii to become this huge football superstar. And that was something that people related to. And it was really interesting. There were one of the night shows, I can't remember which one, the talk show host had did just random interviews with people saying, you know, what do you think of the Manti Te'o story? You know, what do you think of the scandal? And a lot of them had expressed, well, I had questions about it. I kind of thought it was weird that, you know, that both his grandmother and girlfriend died on the same day. But I really wanted to believe the triumph of the human spirit.
Right.
You know, and that he was able to do that. And so I think that plays a huge part to it, that's what we want to see. And to me, that is a reflection of the larger American community and that American dream that's so embedded in who, you know, in what America is and what it represents to the rest of the world.
Awesome. That is a great thing to add in. That's a great layer. Let's go back to Mormonism for just one second, too. There's another piece besides Paul Dunn, and I think it's the very influential talk that, again, maybe many in our community won't be aware of. But back, I believe it was in the late 80s or early 90s, Elder Packer, Boyd K. Packer, who's president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, gave a talk. I can't remember the setting. I think it was to institute teachers, church education system people. And he called it "The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect." And what he was doing is he was sort of reacting to what they called the new Mormon history at the time, which was more open to looking at the naturalistic forces that were at play in some of the you know, events of Mormonism. Instead of saying it's purely God coming out of the blue and telling Joseph Smith about the word of wisdom, you know, it was let's be more open to talk about temperance movements and things that we're all about. And so he was reacting to that as well as what they would call warts in all history, this idea of treating the prophets and the early leaders as fully fledged human beings, you know, being more open about their weaknesses and stuff. So he gives this talk called The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect, which he tells the seminary teachers, you know, not all history is important to share. you know, we want to emphasize those things which are inspiring, which will lead to, you know, them having life. So I can't remember, what is it? All truth is not useful. Stephen, are you remembering any of the language from it or something like that? Even though something's true, it may not be useful. And his whole thing was the utility of the story you would tell. And so I think that's a piece of Mormon thoughts too. And I loved your categories from those scholars, Stephen. One of them was called the sacred narrative, right? The overarching, the highest ideals one. And mm-hmm. So I think in some ways with Teo, we've got a little piece of that going too. Do you think so, you guys?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I just think that while I agree that not all information is always important to the moral conversation, that this idea of addiction to the story really resonates with me, that's our immaturity as human beings, and specifically as members of the church, to the degree that we do that we want so much to believe in a narrative that makes us feel secure, that makes us feel that God is going to be there at every turn, or that all is going to be well. I mean, that while it maybe relieves us from the anxiety of the imperfection of life, given that we're not in the Garden of Eden, that, you know, even though it may give us some temporary comfort, it may not really help us navigate the landscape, so to speak. And, you know, I do see in my clinical experience a lot of those, you know, when people realize that their roadmap is completely insufficient for the landscape that they're in and that they're falling apart because of it. And, you know,
it would have been nice to have the warts and all presentation, because
right.
then they would have been inoculated, is one of the other words that comes out, right?
That's right. And, you know, when I think about how I interact with my children around our faith and, you know, our belief, that I'm quite open with them about how I see it as the immaturity in our own faith, our the imperfection of it, that it's in evolution, and that, you know, our integrity is really the most important thing, that what choose the right doesn't mean necessarily loyalty to the church as much as it means loyalty to our integrity, that we're really striving that's our role as members of the church. So that's kind of the narrative that I think is more helpful or more inclusive and is going to be more inoculating for them down the road. I think that, you know, many people in faith transitions are doing exactly that they're being disillusioned from the story they were given. And then there's not an alternative one that's right. offered by the community right. to help them stay.
Yeah, or they won't have the patience to find that,
yes.
the 100 years of conversation that, you know, those who've gone through it, yeah, it's just that quick reaction of I'm rudderless now.
Right.
Without that story that can lead to some big decisions getting made in an awful hurry.
Right.
There was one piece of this, though, you know, because I agree with you, but here's Teo, and a lot of the things where he's clearly lying or he's letting the sacred narrative of the dead girlfriend kind of go, you know, and even just calling her his girlfriend, you know, is a code word for somebody would think, I definitely have a, you know, face-to-face relationship with this person at some time. But he would let this thing go on. What about the soundbite culture? The fact that, like, when you are a seminary teacher or somebody, you only have 50 minutes a day, you know, there's sort of the pace at which you need to communicate. Is that cut anybody any slack, you guys? And even on Sunday, you only have a limited amount of time. Do we really want to wrestle with things, or do we want to just get right to the moral?
Yeah, I actually wrote an article for you once about that, Dan. I don't know if you remember it.
I'm sure I remember it, but you'll have to remind me. I published you so many times.
Yeah, I enumerated the deadly sins of giving lessons, but I actually believe that one of the reasons why we have such a difficult time talking in nuanced ways about the gospel and about the church and about the difficult corners of those things is simply because teachers don't prepare enough. And the students don't prepare enough. Because when I get ready for, like, for example, about 2 months ago, I had to give a talk in church. I spent at least 10 hours getting that ready. And I think that would blow most Mormons' minds.
Right.
It was only a 10-minute talk, so for every hour I put into it, I got a minute out of it. And when my wife puts together her lessons for gospel doctrine, she puts in at least 10 hours for her lessons. And the reason why it's so important to really prepare for these is because you need to find the right questions. Because that's what makes a conversation go well, is when the person who's facilitating the conversation has thought way ahead, thought of all the people who were there, and say, how can I put a question together that will make it so it's not easy to answer? And then, you know, what are the little points along the way where I can give a little bit of help or a little nudge this way and that? But of course, the manuals don't teach that at all. But I think that you'll find whenever you go into a really good lesson and you say, wow, go and talk to that teacher and find out how much work he or she put into it. But nobody's going to do it. I know this. I have a testimony of it.
And it's also quite frustrating as a student going into the class, having been prepared, and then the teacher comes and they're not prepared.
Right.
And so that's always...
So, yeah, and we're talking Mormonism here, but we're just talking human nature and human beings mostly. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there are those pieces of our culture that add some stuff to there. But I thought that the Packer idea of, you know, leave out that which isn't necessarily inspirational. There is a piece of it that, you know, time and, you know, why clutter with extraneous things when we know that there's still somebody that's worth looking up to, so why emphasize the rest? But then, of course, we get the sense of, you know, depression and guilt and feeling like I fall short because I recognize in the full complexity of my own life that I am a human being with all these flaws. And I begin to think of these prophets and these figures that are set up in these idealized ways as being a different species from me. I can never measure up, and we get down on ourselves, and it can really harm us in our own spiritual progress. So
Well, think about it from Plato's point of view. I mean, this is kind of exactly what he taught, was that in order to keep a society running well, there has to be the noble myth, right?
Right.
There has to be the big unquestionable thing that will get you if you don't go along with things, because he didn't trust people to rationally want to keep the society going just because it would keep the society going. And I think that's very much what that's based on.
Hmm. Terrific. Terrific. And anything more in this pressure to conform, pressure to be thought of in a certain way?
I have a couple of thoughts. I mean, I actually, Stephen, your point that this is just about people not preparring enough is actually a very hopeful idea for me, because I tend to not think it's, I mean, I think that there's truth in what you're saying, but I tend to see it more as a function in some ways of our immaturity just as human beings, not just in the church, but in society, or just as people, that we often don't want to deal with the truth. We don't want to deal with the things that make us uncomfortable. We want to trust. We want to have a structure that gives security and stability to our lives. And when we have data that undermines that security, we tend to want to push it away, even though it may ultimately hurt us more. And so I see clients do that all the time, but as an outsider, I'm seeing all the data that would suggest he is having an affair and she won't let herself know it in her gut. And, you know, and it's more because she can't take, it's so destabilizing that she's very good at not letting herself know it and then colluding in the deception. So I guess I would say that sometimes I think we perpetuate sort of, like, what is it about sound bites? I mean, I don't know if it's about sound bites. It's about what is the message that we're going to give in that short talk or that short lesson, and how good of a roadmap is it that we're willing to give? And I think it has a lot to do with how willingly we are to share what our experience is and how it's taught us about that roadmap. And there's a lot of pressure sometimes not to share the complexity of the roadmap, I think.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think you're showing us the line between stability and intimacy. And I would agree with you that most people go to church to gain stability rather than intimacy. However, as anyone who's really experienced true intimacy knows, intimacy is a lot awesomer than stability, but it's also much more difficult to achieve.
That's right. Well,
much more vulnerability. Yeah.
That's right. I agree.
Awesome. Anything else, Jennifer? You said you had a couple. I don't know if
other idea I had was something that Chelsea Fife wrote in one of our exchanges was that, you know, Mormons love to have answers. And also she mentioned this idea of the superficial, like that because of this narrative of being good yields, you know, positive results in our lives and so on, that there is actually protection against intimacy, that we want to be seen in a particular light and we want to be known in a particular, we want to be validated or recognized as something, but not really known. And, you know, I think it's just another mechanism through which we perpetuate the a narrative that's simplistic. And so, again, you know, as a therapist, I have the experience of seeing people that I know from the larger LDS community then come into my office and you see this exterior interior juxtaposition. It can be very striking, the difference sometimes. It's quite amazing.
Yeah, and Chelsea, among the things that she talked about, not exactly the point you were making there, but she says because of this recognizing within ourselves that we're not matching what we portray, you know, our authentic self is not this one there too. Perhaps that leads to some of the high rates of antidepressant use, overwhelming high rates of secret pornography use, high use of plastic surgery in Utah, debt rates for Mormons, prescription drug abuse, the list goes on and on. Just again, that sense of I need to be inspirational. I need to look like I've got it together. I need to look like I'm perfectly healthy in all these other ways. And this leads to that.
Right.
All right. Here's where I want to go left. You guys, I don't know. Have anybody besides me did anybody watch the press conference from the athletic director at Notre Dame as he talked about the Tao story when it first broke?
Yeah, I watched that.
That guy loves Manti Te'o. Mm-hmm. You can just tell. I mean, his heart was broken. And among the things that he said is a line. I'm not reading it. But he says, what is the saddest thing from him is the most trusting person that he's ever met will never be able to trust again or not be able to trust in that same way. And there's this sense, and from what I, you know, I'd followed Te'o, especially this year, and there was this idea that he was this leader, and part of his leadership and his ability to rally everybody in the locker room and things like that was almost from this purity of soul, this above reproachness thing. And Swarbrick, who's met him up close and you know, hung with him and loves him, I think there's this attractiveness to just this guy that seems so different than the rest of us. And I don't know, to me, I would never want my own child to be as naive as Manti Te'o is in terms of, you know, at some point earlier than he did, you know, and every time you're ready to meet her or every time you get on Facebook with each other or on Skype with each other and she says, I can see you. How come your machine won't see me, you know, as you're talking to me and all those different things. At some point, I would want my child I need proof that you're a real person a little bit stronger than he was giving her. I wouldn't want my child to be that naive, but on the other hand, I feel a real loss, kind of like Swarbrick was saying here in Te'o, to see this guy who's so open and trusting, he's got to be deeply wounded by this. Mm-hmm. And yet there was a purity and a power, some of his power and his magnetism came out of the purity that could only come with the naivete. Mm-hmm. What do you guys think? And Jennifer, part of the reason I wanted to do this is in one of your notes ahead of time, you talked about a person who's been betrayed in a marriage, and when do they trust again and things like that. And I would love to explore a little bit with you guys just that. What are the wounds in our heart as we read this story about Te'o? What do we see as prospects for healing for him? And then, you know, always keeping in mind that there's all of us here with these kinds of wounds, mm-hmm. and maybe we can say something that makes good sense for those the rest of us in our wounds.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, how to articulate it all easily, but I would say that, you know, there is something sweet and endearing about the level of trust and the purity of that trust, and it's, you know, maybe we kind of envy it in a way. Maybe that's why he had so much influence in the locker room, so to speak, with his teammates, because maybe we remember that innocence and that. I remember finding out that Santa Claus wasn't real, and I actually envied my younger self. I envied the ability to believe and just believe purely and to wonder if the sound on the roof were the reindeer and so on. And I remember, you know, missing that feeling. But I think that, unfortunately, to grow up and to function well in the world, you know, this is how I see it a little bit, is that, you know, that in fact our greater ability to stand on our own two feet is highly correlated with our ability to actually depend upon and trust others, even though it sounds like the two are in opposition to one another. And, right. you know, that our you know, that our immaturity is often that the more dependent we are upon other people, the less able we are to actually be in trusting, stable relationships, because we aren't bringing enough of our own good judgment into whether or not a relationship is worthy of our trust or worthy of our investment. So, you know, that when I'm working with people where there's been a betrayal, that often, you know, the betrayed is saying, how can I ever trust you again? I'm never going to be able to trust you. And they're kind of looking outside of themselves to have some proof that this person is not going to betray them again, and some reassurance to come from that other person, which it's never going to work that way, because in many ways where part of the betrayal was within themselves, that they didn't let themselves kind of take in the information around them. They were being too dependent upon the other person, essentially. And it's a kind of immature, it's an immature kind of trust, in my opinion. You know, in some ways I think of it as you never give 100%, but you will happily give 95%. And what I mean by that is that there's always a part of you that's tracking whether or not this person is remaining worthy of your trust, and that you know that you can kind of take care of yourself, or that you can redefine your reality if you need to, that you're not going to give your full dependency to another person, because that's more of a childlike position. That's more of a child parent position. As an adult, I think you have to be able to, it sounds like the two can't coexist, but I think they do coexist, that you both are able to trust because you also trust yourself. You trust your ability to navigate your world well, and to really track the people around you and whether they are worthy of that investment and that trust.
Wonderful. Stephen or Anna Pessy, in terms of the gain and the loss, this—I don't know. I'm just trying to get to this wounds and being grown up and mature in the right way without losing the strength of purity.
Well,
go ahead, Stephen.
Okay, I'll say something. When you go through and look at the structures of myths and the structures of stories and like the Amana myth that Joseph Campbell hypothesized, you come quickly to the realization that there are no stories about the pure soul who remains pure. It just doesn't happen. Mm. Every story is about the person who had to grow up. Mm. That's all there is to it. and so Teo is going through that time now. He's going into his second act. But at the same time, I think that Jennifer brought up a really good point, which is that I think that the thing that we love so much about the person we perceive as pure is not the purity itself, but connecting to sort of the purity of soul that we once had before, I'm going to sound like Rousseau here, before culture started to mold us and turn us into what it wanted instead of what we are. So if you believe that there's sort of a core to us, and that core does sort of get molded by our outside influences in ways that are not helpful to us, and I sort of believe that, then we look back on those people. We look at children who still run down the street and who still sing the ABC song in the middle of the store, and we remember, yes, I once also acted according to what was in my soul, and I no longer do that. I think that that's the thing that we're envying, not their untouchedness, because the untouched is a myth. Well, I don't want to say myth, but an unreality.
Anna Pessy?
Yeah, I agree with what has been said. And I know when I first heard about it, my first reaction was, how could you be so stupid? Like, I mean, that was like, I just internally, that was my first reaction. Like, how can you not know? You know, this has been a 3-year relationship. Like, how can you not know? How can people around you not know? You know, and even when I watched the press conference from Notre Dame, I read it as Notre Dame trying to save face in regards to their own reputation as a university. And that was my initial reaction to it, because that's how I take in information and that's how I see it, you know, kind of scrutinizing the information and really looking at it. And that was my first reaction. But after I sat back and kind of thought a little bit more about the situation, and then looked at young people that I work with who have also come from La'ie, who have been in very similar situations, who have also struggled in many ways with something similar to what he has gone through, but not on a public scale, certain things started to make sense to me. And which really forced me to look at it from a different perspective. And it then moved from this questioning of, you know, like, how could this be, more to concern, like just real concern about him and the burden of that responsibility, and what then happens to a young kid, you know, at the age of 21, who has now gone through an experience like this in the public eye, and who is there to support him, who's there to give him, you know, the kind of advice, or who's there to help him. Like, those questions started going through my mind as I started to think that he's actually not, this story to me is not something that is really as huge as, I mean, when I look at it, this is an ordinary story to me. I know so many young people who've been in this same situation, but haven't had to experience the story in the limelight and in the public eye and being scrutinized in that way. So to me, it is something that is common. We often, and if anyone's listening from La'ie, they're going to be really mad at me, but it's always been a joke that all of us call La'ie the Twilight Zone, because when you enter into there, it's like everyone thinks the world is so wonderful. And, you know, it's just a different feeling. And that's what I was trying to get in the beginning, that we've had a lot of great athletes come out from La'ie, and we've had some that have been recruited by the University of Utah. And my experiences with them have been the same, where this is their first time out of there. And it's almost like, where did you live again? What world do you live in? You know, and a lot of times, yeah. And a lot of time people say that about me when I come from Utah, and they're like, well, do you guys know about this in Utah? Or, you know, people will, like, there's a perception of Utah. But I know in working with athletes and with students up at the university who have come from there, that there have been times where I have been teaching, I'll teach the class and they'll make comments, and I think, wait, what, where do you live? You know, like, what are you talking about? What century are you in? And so I could see how these experiences are, and how there's just a really pure innocence in a way that's also very naive about the rest of the world. And some of that is great, because they have a certain kind of support that's there. And that's something I envy when I go into La'ie. There is an extreme support. And when, you know, when Manti was you know, when they had this whole thing with the Heisman, you know, they shut down everything basically to support him. And even now, when this has happened, the strongest community that has come to embrace him, protect him, shelter him again is that very same La'ie community. And so in some ways that can be very detrimental when you're coming from there to somewhere where you don't have that same kind of the support. And so I think that what Manti does have that I really was attracted to is he has this really strong foundation of how he sees the world as something that is because in some of the interviews, what I felt most from him was that he was still racking his brain to understand how anyone could play such a cruel joke on him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Whereas the rest of us are like, that happens every day. You know, right. It's why are you so trusting? Whereas I felt that he was saying, well, why would anybody do that? I just don't understand why people would even engage in something to go that far. And, you know, and so that to me, like when I look at it, I think that there is this changes. I'm sure that this experience will change him in a certain way, you know, obviously. But at the same time, I think that there is something that he brought, you know, in the way that he was that as mentioned, really people were attracted and gravitated toward that. And if any of you visit La'ie, you'll know what I'm talking about. it's very different. And even though they have the largest tourist center with the Polynesian Cultural Center, where they have a lot of tourists come through, but there is a very strong sense of community there that I haven't seen anywhere else, with the exception of in the islands. And so, you know, and so that made me really think about his experience. And I think it kind of helped me to sort of step back and reevaluate this situation and what is happening. But really a lot of it was just concern for what happens to him. You know, how does he move from this? You know, there's been individuals in our community who have committed suicide from this kind of thing, where they were put up in a pedestal in a certain way, and then all of a sudden something happens, and then we never hear from them again, and then later we find them, you know, dead somewhere. And so as a person who works in the community and who understands some of that thing, that was kind of my biggest concern about this, that, you know, what kind of support is he receiving to work through, you know, this situation?
Yeah, awesome. You know, a piece of what I think we're getting at here is there's this wonderful strength that can come from a community like you're talking about. And yet those of us who've been betrayed, there's that whole mentality, I won't be fooled again. And so there's that dynamic here. And I think so many of us, especially like when Mormonism begins to crash and burn or get more complicated, or, you know, just things are really getting tossed and turned around for us, we will emphasize that I won't get fooled again here, and we'll forget how still great it was to have that strength and that stability and that, you know, purity in our lives too. And so I would love to always make sure that in my own life, in my own heart, I've got that dynamic going of the skepticism and you know, the due diligence, but always remembering with gratitude and, you know, the stuff that really formed me to make me a strong person. Other thoughts on trusting, or just really, are we ready to go to just closing, you know, closing thoughts at all? Let's just go through the group. Stephen, you haven't talked in the last little bit, so can we lead with you? It's just what else about this story on any aspect that you'd want to make as sort of a heading towards the end?
I don't have a lot left to say. The only thing that came to my mind that would probably be my parting shot is a quote from Parker Blunt, who writes for Sunstone a lot in a recent issue. He says, "One day I was on Temple Square in Salt Lake City looking at the Seagull Monument. As I appraised the monument, I thought of the travails of the children of Israel in the wilderness. At one point, they encountered poisonous snakes, and as a remedy, Moses constructed a pole with a bronze snake affixed to the top. Those who looked upon the handcrafted snake were healed of their snake bites. Looking up at those bronze seagulls atop the granite column, I wondered what might happen to people, like me, who really looked at the monument. Would we be healed of our gullibility?
Seagulls. Awesome.
Anyway. Just in case you needed something to do at Temple Square next time you're there.
Ponder that. Oh, interesting. Well, thank you for being on the show, Stephen. I really have loved your insights. And boy, just the training and the things that you're alerted to were just fantastic. So thanks for sharing.
Sure, you can send me my check later. You guys aren't getting a check?
Oh, man. Do not. Everyone who has ever been on the show, do not listen to that man.
You know, we're not that gullible, Steve.
Jennifer, where would you go here in closing?
Let's see. I guess what I would say is that, you know, I think it's a little bit the tension you're talking about is like, you know, is faith or trust a good thing, or ultimately does it screw us over? You know, I mean, I think that's kind of where we're, once we become disillusioned, like, can we really have faith or really trust again? And, you know, I guess what I would say is that in my experience, you know, my faith has matured a lot, but I still have faith. But I think I would qualify it as a grounded faith, or what I think of as a faith that's really sort of based in my integrity, not so much my hope for that's based in fear, or, you know, hope that is driven by, you know, my own anxieties. So I think, you know, when I think about when I really trust in something, or I start to put faith in something that I don't yet fully kind of know what the outcome will be, that are really important. There's sort of two pieces I'm thinking about, is sort of what's driving my faith in this. You know, is it narcissism? Is it fear? Is it anxiety? Or is it like my courage, my integrity to do what I really think is right, even if it's not fully comfortable for me? And, you know, if it's the latter, that's an important litmus test for me. I think the other thing is that I guess I really believe in a thoughtful faith, that the intellect is maybe counter to some people's way of approaching their faith. For me, is very fundamental to me kind of discerning what I think is really true. And I really think that's my responsibility as a child of God, as a member of the church, to really be discerning and to use my own relationship to God and the Spirit to think about and reason through what I really believe is true based in my experience, my feelings, and my thoughts about it. And so I really don't divorce those two. I mean, I really feel like they work part and parcel together. And I think, you know, at least, you know, I have a testimony of how fruitful that marriage has been for me in the sense of helping me lead a happy life. So those are my thoughts.
Wonderful. Thank you. And you know, that piece a little bit with my don't, I won't be fooled again, and going back somewhat to the spouse that had been betrayed, and just that forgiveness of ourselves for not having got it the whole time. You know, that I don't know, that just seems like such a big piece that, yeah, I was so gullible and I'll never be that gullible again, but we need to forgive ourselves for missing those signs. And I don't know, that's just a piece that I wanted to jump with, but thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you for being on. You've been fantastic. Anna Pessy, would you bring us home?
Gosh, now I have to say something inspirational. I'm kidding.
Tell the right story, Anna Pessy.
Well, first of all, I'm just grateful for this discussion. You know, I've been following some of the different discussions that's been out there about this story and have really wanted to hear something different about this, you know, what has happened. And so this has been really nice for me to be able to engage in this discussion with all of you and to be able to bring up some critical points that I think has been missed by the mainstream media. But of course, they're the mainstream media, so they're going to miss a lot of things. Right. And so just wanted to say thank you for putting this podcast together and for this discussion. I think one of the things that really stood out to me, and especially in a lot of the work that I do with young Pacific Islanders, is what was brought up with the whole hero worship and how do we look at role models? What do we expect of them? Because I think that we all play a role in putting various individuals, as we've talked about, on these pedestals. And when they do fall, we kind of move out of the way and not engage in any of that healing process together with them. And I think that's something that I have been in discussion with a lot of young Pacific Islanders who really look to him as a role model, and who saw him as a person that, you know, they wanted to model their life after. And so when something like this happens, it also crushes their dreams also, in a sense, because of how much they've invested in an individual or in a person or in a persona or in a story as dictated by the media. And so it's been really good for me also, because I have also seen him in that way. And I was also an individual who also, you know, talked about him, praised him, you know, for the work that he was doing, and also the kind of media attention that he was receiving. And so it was, you know, it made me also rethink the way in which myself, especially in the work that I do, in putting that one individual who sort of carries that full representation of everything. And one of the things that I wanted the young people that I work with to understand, that yes, this is a situation that has happened to him, but it doesn't discount and disregard all of the work that he has done that has gotten him to where he's at. And that there is still some really great and wonderful aspects of his life and what he's been able to do that is being neglected because of the focus on this particular story and this particular narrative. And so it's been nice to be on this podcast to kind of give some of that perspective, and to show that although this is something that, you know, the discussions that are happening, you know, about it, that it is much more complex and than what we are seeing. And so that's been really nice for me, and especially for all of our young people and students who will also be listening to this podcast, because it's mandatory for them to do so tomorrow or whenever you put it up. It's part of their grade.
Oh, well, hey, and new so, listeners. Like, you know,
for them to listen to it, because I want to have this conversation with them, and I'm really grateful for the different perspectives that's been brought up about this situation and story.
Oh, thank you so much. That was fantastic. And absolutely, this young man's life is not over. His story is being written, and it's going to be a more complex story, and there's every chance in the world that he's going to just triumph over, you know, over this. The possibilities are there. Somehow we're along the line, and I've been thinking of Junior Seau. You know, I grew up in San Diego, and I got a San Diego Chargers sticker on the back of my car and all that stuff. And so he was this person, and to realize that after his suicide, there was that disappointment and whatnot. And then, you know, I have to admit, in the last 10 days or whatever it was, just this relief that indeed the brain study showed that it had trauma, you know, that he was suffering from this, and it would have led to the depression. And there's that, you know, I have to ask myself, am I looking to have my hero rescued by brain trauma, you know, or here and whatever, but we don't need perfect icons. We just need human beings. And even if his suicide had been, you know, just for something dark, something that we really wouldn't want to see in him, that does not negate all the other things and how we stood taller, and that it was possible in our lives to be inspired. Let's not forget that we were moved and we were better, you know, even if it gets complexified later and keep striving. So thank you, you guys. This was the perfect panel, a wonderful discussion, and I can't thank you enough, and I will get this up as soon as I can do it. And I just wish you all a great good night.
Thanks,
thank
Dan.
You.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye. Give me music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.